Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
BBC. You're with the BBC, also podcasting via bbcworldservice.com. And with our weekly look at technology from around the world, this is Digital Planet, and I'm Gareth Mitchell. Hello, and welcome along. Today, the march of the mobile continues, but could economics make the most rural communities out of range?
When you look at the cost of putting a new base station in to cover perhaps a new village or group of villages, you're talking about the cost not only of the base station, but of the road, of the electricity, and that cost can therefore multiply many times.
And also today, just as the English Football Premiership reached its nail-biting climax this weekend, the beautiful game became the very tiniest game. The crowd goes wild as we bring you microscopic soccer on a chip.
You hit a button and it goes and it figures out where the obstacles are and it can then move, for instance, pick up a ball and move it into a goal or that kind of thing.
Apparently it's true. That's all coming up on Digital Planet from the BBC. Well, first, though, we're going to catch up on the situation in Burma and the efforts of aid workers to get into the region that's been affected by that massive cyclone. Now, when we recorded this programme last week, the death toll was estimated to just be in the hundreds. But as we're all aware, the full extent of the disaster has become tragically apparent since then. One of the NGOs trying to get into the country is Telecom Sans Frontières, which specialises in bringing emergency telecoms and internet connectivity into disaster zones. Their delegate in the Asia Pacific region is Simon Zhenin, and earlier I spoke to him from Bangkok in neighbouring Thailand. Now, I should say here that the sound quality in the interview isn't perfect, I'm afraid. That's because Simon was on his mobile phone and he couldn't get to a landline to speak to us. Now, he told me what the priority is going to be if his NGO can gain access to the region.
If we want really to be useful, we would have to go in the affected areas, in the main cities in the south. We have planned to set up in 3 locations. I still have to prioritize it. I don't know yet how is the situation, and this will be defined from Rangoon.
And definitely there, as he was alluding to, Rangoon is already reasonably well covered by the standards of the region with telecom. So the priority is to get out actually into the remote regions around that delta. Now, Simon went on to tell me then about the equipment that he hopes to take into Burma with him, assuming he can get permission.
It's satellite phones, satellite modems for internet access, computers, printers, Wi-Fi access. And what we used to do is to set up a center here with the sat phones. We set up a wireless network so people who have laptops with Wi-Fi, which everybody has today, they can just come and plug in and use the internet access to send their pictures, to send their reports, assessments. It's a really a vital tool on the field when you don't have any other means to communicate.
So they have a load of satellite and mobile equipment, and also they hope to set up various wireless networks so that anybody who needs to can get onto the internet. But one suggestion I put to Simon was that as a telecoms NGO, one problem that Telecom Sans Frontières might face that other volunteers won't necessarily is that its whole function is to connect these remote regions of Burma with the outside world. Now, the country's secretive military rulers, of course, may be very reluctant to allow that. But Simon reckons a bit of diplomacy should get round most difficulties.
We'll have to highlight the fact that the Burmese authorities are in the same situation that all the other NGOs or UN agencies. They don't have communication in those areas. So we'll have to highlight that first we come to support them also so that they would be able to use these facilities, but in condition and only if anyone can use it. So this is another question. Will they agree on it? I believe they will agree because they really need the communications also.
Simon Zhenin there of Telecom Sans Frontières, and apologies again for the sound quality there, but we really wanted to get him on, so I hope you'll forgive us for that. But Bill Thompson is here. He joins us every week as our studio commentator. And Bill, Simon seems to think that certainly the deal with those military rulers in Burma is, well, you know, this equipment is going to be good for you. We need this. In a way, there's no choice. Do you think that they'll take his point?
I wish I could feel as optimistic about it as he does. I mean, there seems no evidence that they're going to shift substantially. And I can't see them welcoming TSF in there, given that their motivation is to provide access to the outside world. The military have their own communications kit. If you can get soldiers into a place, they come, you know, with wireless, with all that sort of stuff, for their own needs. They're equipped to be mobile. So I suspect that that deal won't work, and we just have to hope that, you know, the rules in Burma do open up slightly to allow people there to communicate.
OK, now, obviously, there have been some real difficulties in the Asia-Pacific region. We've heard in the last day or so of the earthquake in China. And, Bill, so interesting how technology plays a role here, in this case, in telling us in the outside world about what's been going on there. How did you first hear about this?
Well, that's right. I found out about it because it was in the early hours of the morning, UK time. When I got up, people were on the Twitter mobile network talking about it, and that's where I picked up some information that this had happened and could find out from some people on the ground and also other people reporting what was going on. So for me, it wasn't the conventional news networks that got the information out. It was, in fact, this service called Twitter, which is more like a social network. Quite fascinating. Of course, these networks only work because people in the affected areas already had access to them. And one of the big problems that we face in Burma is very little information came out because Burma is a closed society. The telecoms infrastructure wasn't there to start with. It's not like TSF are going in to try to replace something that is broken. It just wasn't there to start with.
Okay, Bill, yeah, and it is funny because this morning, actually, I put the radio on before I actually kept up with my Twitter updates. Otherwise, I suspect I'd have probably heard about it through Twitter first. All right, Bill, we'll speak to you again in a few moments because this week sees the great and the good of the mobile phone industry, alongside all kinds of representatives of government and development organisations, converging on Cairo in Egypt. The International Telecommunication Union, the ITU, is hosting Telecom Africa, which is a major networking event for anyone with an interest in making sure that Africa really does become a force in its own right in the global telecoms community. Now, there's bound to be lots of talk of city traders buying and selling stocks via their top-of-the-range smartphones. But at the grassroots, many will be thinking in Cairo very much about the very hard-working people, like the auto rickshaw drivers who ply their trade on those dusty streets away from the conference venue, as our reporter Eva Dadrian has been finding out.
Mahmoud drives a tuk-tuk, a battery-powered engine rickshaw that has become the main means of transport in some parts of Cairo where streets are so narrow that cars can't get through. The tuk-tuk can take 3 passengers. It has 3 wheels and a weather guard to protect passengers from the scorching sun. It runs on a very small battery, but a number of drivers have installed more powerful batteries, which they also use for playing music. Mahmoud tells me that he often recharges his mobile phone directly from his tuk-tuk.
You can buy a kind of an electric wire from the market and a jack. Then, with tiny clamps, you just connect your mobile phone to the car battery. It's neither easy nor difficult. And, of course, there are other more conventional ways of doing this. But as we're driving and working long hours, we found it's easier to recharge our mobiles on the spot while we're driving.
Amr also drives a tuk-tuk, and he too recharges his mobile from the battery of his vehicle.
My name is Amir. I usually do it with 2 electric wires, one ground and one neutral. It's easy, very easy. You just insert the wires into the battery and then bring the 2 other ends together and insert them into your mobile. You can also connect the charger directly onto the battery. But this can be done only on the tuk-tuks that are new, for example, those of year 2008 and year 2007. But you can't do it on the ones of year 2006 because the battery is under the seat.
That's Amma, who's a tuk-tuk driver in Cairo, talking there to Eva Dadrian. And of course, both those rickshaw drivers raised a really important point there, and that's how you power your mobile phone and keep it charged. Taking the electricity straight from their vehicles certainly seems to be a good solution for them. But of course, powering the handsets is one thing, but as networks spring up in some of the most rural spots on Earth, what about powering the actual base stations themselves? Well, I brought that up with Tom Phillips, the Chief Government and Regulatory Affairs Officer at the GSM Association, which is the trade body for the mobile phone industry. It's also present at this week's Cairo get-together.
Networks use a lot of power, and that power can be very expensive. If we think, you know, typically what the oil price is doing today, most of the base stations that are used to power mobile networks are oil-fired up and diesel generator. So it's an expense, operating cost, ongoing expense. The second thing is to roll out networks requires very often the positioning of base stations in fairly remote locations. And in a lot of the markets that we're talking about, particularly in emerging markets, those remote locations are well off the grid. They're not currently connected to electricity supplies. Indeed, transportation might be quite difficult to some of those places. And when you look at the cost of putting a new base station in to cover perhaps a new village or group of villages, you're talking about the cost not only of the base station, but of the road, of the electricity, and so on and so forth. And that cost can therefore multiply many times. So what the GSMA has been doing with its members is looking at how we can make those base stations more self-sustaining. And that's looking at alternative sources of power away from either networked electricity or diesel generation.
So part of the challenge is powering the base station. Is there any research going into reducing the amount of power that base stations use?
Most of the big manufacturers are investing quite heavily in that. I mean, one of the areas you'll be aware of, most people will be familiar with this, base stations use a lot of air conditioning. And in some of the markets where getting energy into a base station is most difficult, that air conditioning is one of the biggest consumers of energy. Now, if, for example, we can run those base stations a few degrees hotter, you can cut quite significantly the power consumption.
Tom Phillips there. Well, Bill Thompson is still here. And a really good point there that Tom was making about, you know, how hot these chips operate at.
Well, I know anybody who uses a laptop will know that, you know, their laptops get pretty hot, that modern chips do run hot. It's a problem because that's waste heat. And obviously there are two things you can do. You can try to re-engineer the components so they don't generate as much heat. And that's certainly happening. We've got Intel's new Atom chipset, for example, which is significantly lower power consumption. We've got lots of work going on in that area. But this sense of as a temporary measure for using existing components to let them run a bit hotter and just make them more reliable seems to be quite an eminently sensible suggestion, frankly.
Absolutely. And, of course, lots of alternative power sources that might be used in these remote stations. I'd have thought solar would be very high up on the list because, you know, they may be in sunny places and often where you can't run mains electricity to them very easily.
And certainly with the massive improvements we're seeing in photovoltaic cell manufacturing, solar power generally, it would be an obvious thing to do. If you're going to have a base station, a building, than to put solar panels on it. And as long as you've got battery technology as well to store energy, because what you don't want is to be reliant on an energy source which might be variable. So you do need to have the backup. As long as that's in place, the whole thing can work quite well.
All right. Well, Bill, let's just hear a little bit more from Tom Phillips, because he's been talking about some of the more traditional means of powering mobile phones and the base stations too.
We've worked with a number of companies already to provide small solar chargers, quite flexible, robust solar chargers that can trickle charge a phone if left in the sun. I think there's still a long way to go, though, in that area, and I think that's one of the ways in which mobile will become, you know, a real sort of integral part of people's lives. I don't know if you're like me, but one of the most important things for me in a mobile phone is that its battery life is good. I mean, if a battery lasts a day, it's no good. I want it to last a week.
Absolutely, you know, more than any other feature, I think. Yeah. You know, you can have great games on it, a little calculator function, who cares?
Yeah.
If the battery doesn't last...
Colour screen, who cares? But if the battery, you know, if the battery goes flat after you've used it for a couple of hours, it's frankly an annoyance for us sitting here, for example, next to a socket. But if you're in the, you know, a fairly remote place, it's really very, very awkward indeed and very difficult.
And I suppose if we do end up with a culture where people are doing all these kind of web functions and email on their mobile handsets rather than cranking up a great big desktop computer to do it, that's going to have energy savings too.
It's got to have, hasn't it? And it's got to have energy savings not only as you use the device, but also in the manufacturing of that device. I mean, if you think of the power and the energy consumed, the carbon produced in producing a desktop computer compared to a small handheld mobile device, there's a very big difference. And, you know, I multiply that many millions, hundreds of millions, ultimately, when mobile broadband is ubiquitous as voice mobile is today, then it's a huge impact.
Tom Phillips there. So, Bill, there must be so many different ways that you can save power on your mobile phone because, I mean, it's got the radio component, but also the screen. That's a very important part of it, isn't it?
It is. I mean, and modern bright screens consume a lot of electricity. It's interesting that one of the people behind the One Laptop Per Child project, Mary Lou Jepson, who developed the screens that they use, which are very low-power screens, has now moved on and is going to be exploiting that technology commercially in other areas. And I'm sure it won't be long before we see that sort of technology in smartphones that are available in developing countries.
And I love the way that people are so ingenious with charging their mobile phones, like those Tok Tok drivers in Cairo. Just plug it into the old Tok Tok, charge it away there, no problems. There are other ways of self-powering your mobile phone as well, I'm sure.
There are. Well, I've seen sort of little hand generators that you can get. They're like sort of, you know, the wrist improvers, you see. But as you squeeze them, you generate a little bit of power. You can do that. Obviously, you can use just rechargeable cells and things like that if you're desperate. I mean, the mobile phones are so vital for so many people that a lot of imagination has gone into ensuring you can always get enough power to make that vital call. We just need to make sure that technology is available to anyone who might use it instead of being on sale in airports to desperate, harassed executives.
Okay, yeah. And in fact, I've been interviewing a chap called Max Donnellan in Canada who's come up with a knee brace, like a prosthetic knee brace that converts the movement of your knee into power. And apparently, if you put one on each knee, that's enough to power your handset as well. All good stuff. Right, Bill, we'll speak to you again in a moment. This is Digital Planet, on air, online and podcasting from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Gareth Mitchell, and still to come, not so much a game of two halves, but two microns with the robotic footballer that's smaller than a speck of dust. Well, the novelist and scientist C.P. Snow talked of the two cultures of science and the humanities. That was back in the 1950s. But 50 years on, you could say that two cultures have been meeting in the Senegalese capital, Dakar, on a number of levels, perhaps. Firstly, the cultures of art and technology, but also the cultures of Africa and Europe. The result is a fusion called AfroPixel, calling itself Africa's first ever digital art festival. And for us, Sasha Gankin was there.
Using the latest interactive technology in art is nothing new, but doing it in sub-Saharan Africa is. French artist Jean-Noël Montagnier has travelled around the world with his digital work, but it's the first time he is exhibiting in Senegal. He says this is all down to the availability of open-source software.
We are very happy to make this workshop here because the context is completely different. And because this context here is the perfect illustration of the power of open source technologies, open source hardware, open resources in general.
Jean-Noël has been teaching African students how to use the same software that he does in France. He believes this is key in developing digital art in Africa.
But they know the tools, the concept, they know the way to document it. And psychologically, it's the possibility to them to know that they have the same data that we have. They have the same documentation we have. They can build the same hardware that we have. So this is a completely new approach of creation. But the contents, we do not impose our contents, our Occidental contents. So they can put all their culture, all their emotions with the software.
As open-source software becomes mainstream, Jean-Noël believes that digital art will become increasingly popular in Africa.
People just discover now that there is another solution than Windows. 99% of the people here are pirating Microsoft Windows, and there are a lot of viruses. There are a lot of problems with the hardware because it's old hardware, it's old computers, so it creates a big gap. A digital gap more important than we have in Europe. And with free software, with free operating systems like Linux, like Ubuntu, like Dynabolic, people can use very good tools, very good software without viruses, always up to date. And those tools are completely accessible to any creator, any artist.
Henri Sagna is an artist from Senegal. He says that using open source software is really making a difference to the way he can express himself as an artist.
I work with software, Pure Data. We make sound and we mix it with pictures and we can turn, we can make movement. This is my work. I take some pictures, I put it in the computer, I put a sound of fish to tell that we have a problem in our sea. At this time, many fish pretend to disappear. You know, it's why I speak about this. And this medium helped me to develop my work.
The workshops are proving to be a great inspiration. Oumou Sankare is a student from art school in Bamako in Mali. She made a 2-day trip in temperatures of more than 40 degrees centigrade to be here.
I was mostly impressed with software Padata for video animation. You can download it for free and use it to mix interfaces with sound. I was given all the references and documentation. It's a great privilege and it's very useful.
But what about the art itself? Using the latest technology doesn't guarantee the final piece will be any good. This Senegalese dancer was performing with torches in her hands. Her movements were captured by infrared sensors and transformed using the software into this sound. You can decide for yourself if you like this latest African art.
Well, I've decided for myself. I love it. It's going to be the next ringtone on my mobile phone, I think. That was a participant from Mali at the AfroPixel event, which has just been held in Dakar. The reporter there was Sasha Gankin. Well, finally, the robot that plays soccer, only this little fella, is a fraction of a millimetre in size. So you can imagine how small the ball is. It's all very clever, of course, but it's also just a bit of fun. At least according to the man responsible for it, Bradley Nelson, who's a professor of robotics and intelligent systems. He's devised the Tiny Striker to strike up interest in micro-robotics amongst school students and his own graduates at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich. Bradley Nelson was one of a number of robotics experts at a microsurgery event convened last week by Imperial College London. And after his presentation, which included footage of the micro-footballer controlled by a varying magnetic field, Bradley told me more.
Well, this is a robot that's about 3 hair widths in size, and it moves over a surface, a smooth surface, and we can control it on the plane, and it can maneuver like little specks of dust. In this case, these dusts are a soccer ball or a nano ball, we call it. So, and we can move it around defenders and put it in the goal. And so it's the start of hopefully a long-term competition and try to make nanotechnology and microtechnology that can get kids excited in the classroom about this stuff. So,
what's this little robot made out of?
This robot's made out of a few different materials. It's made out of nickel, and that's how it gets its energy from magnetic fields, because nickel's a soft magnetic material. But it's also made out of gold springs, and copper is also a substrate. So it's just those three materials, gold, copper, and nickel. And you put them in the right combination and with the right patterns, and then you can supply energy to it and get it to vibrate, essentially, and to move in directions that you want.
So this tiny little nickel robot, you know, it's about 300 microns wide, absolutely tiny, and it moves around on a flat surface then, basically. So how do you control it?
Well, we have a microscope overhead looking at it. You can actually see it with your naked eye. It looks like a very small speck of dust if you see it. But you look at it with a microscope, and then you can track it with a camera and provide then the right magnetic field. You provide a magnetic field in the right direction and with the right resonating structure, the right oscillations, and then it will start to move in that direction.
So you literally have somebody on a computer keyboard controlling it with the left and right and the up and down arrow keys then, I suppose.
You can do it that way, but then we also have programs that do it completely autonomously. So you just set it up, you hit a button, and it goes, and it figures out where the obstacles are, and it can then move, for instance, pick up a ball and move it into a goal or that kind of thing. Yeah. So
literally either using like an automated control system or somebody controlling it on a computer keyboard, you can use this tiny little thing, it's the size of a speck of dust, and get it to kick a little ball, which is even smaller. I mean, pretty much an invisible little ball that it can kick around.
That's right. Yeah, it's really fun to watch, and it's also fun. It gets the students, the kids involved. We've shown it at a lot of high schools in Zurich at the gymnasium. We take them to get the students interested in nanotechnology, microtechnology, and it really was motivated by RoboCup, which has been an event going on for 12 years now that builds bigger robots. That actually they're amazing to watch. These teams of robots playing soccer pretty well. It's really a fun competition, but trying to move it down to these scales is. It's a challenge, but it also opens up a whole new area of technology to the students. So that's one of the advantages of it. So,
one of your hidden agendas in getting students to work on this, setting them loose on this, is because maybe at that stage in their careers, they don't know what's impossible, so they're prepared to give anything a try.
That's the great thing about, yeah, getting young students is they don't know how hard it's supposed to be. So they'll say, sure, I'll try that. And, you know, sometimes they really surprise you. That's the great thing about being a professor is seeing students surprise you.
Finally, then, what's the bigger picture here? You know, why are you trying to develop these little robots that are basically the size of a speck of dust?
The real application we're looking at in this case is we're looking at ways we can move small particles within the human body, for instance, to deliver drugs. We're looking right now at eye surgery and delivering drugs to retinal veins at the retina. So we're looking at novel ways of delivering drugs to locations of the body that are very, very difficult to reach. So this is a step on that road, trying to develop the motors that we need and some of just the basic technology that we might use to do that. So.
Literally the Fantastic Voyage kind of stuff then.
Literally. It's like the Fantastic Voyage, only the physics works. The movies had a little problem with the physics, if you ask me, but otherwise it's the same concept.
That's good to know. Bradley Nelson. So Bill Thompson, they fixed the physics and made the Fantastic Voyage possible.
They have, and I can just imagine an eye surgeon there with a PlayStation controller guiding a robot through my eye as it sort of lasers the veins shut and stuff like that. I think this is really interesting, particularly because a few years ago, my son, who's now 15, was heavily into Robot Wars, which is a TV series where you have big metal robots that fight each other. And of course, the prospects of building one of those in my kitchen were slim indeed. But now all I need is a tunneling electron microscope in the house. And I can build a little robot.
Oh, the evenings would fly by at your house, you and your tunnelling electron microscope. But it just goes to show, if you control something that small, the kind of scope that it has.
It does. I mean, it also shows that playing like this, that making it into a game, is a fantastic way to explore the concepts, explore that is, and explore the practicalities that motivates people. We heard there how his students are really into this, but with a really strong practical outcome. And that's what I like about this project, that it makes a lot of sense. The physics does work, and it's clearly going to have, I think, quite quickly, benefits for all of us.
And you and your son can do it in your kitchen. Thank you very much for that, Bill. Also, we've been thinking, what's the most unusual means you have of charging your mobile phone on the back of that discussion from Cairo? Let us know. In fact, I'll tell you what, why not visit our Facebook listeners group and tell us, set up a discussion strand on there. You can find it if you're on Facebook, just type Digital Planet in. I'm in LA next week for the programme, so I'll join you from there. For now, thanks for listening and goodbye.